Welcome to The Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And I am back in D.C. for a couple of days. Hi, Lauren.
I'm so happy you're here.
Thank you for providing me the motivation to clean my apartment, which I left in an unfortunate state that my mother would be very disappointed in. So,
well, as we discussed, my living room and dining room are currently turned into a car wash for mini cars. So, you know, there's options that we could have had, but like we would have been in the middle of a car wash.
You've also conveniently fed me and provided wine. What are we drinking?
We have, I chose this purely because of the name, some sea glass rosé from Monterey County, which
Lovely.
Is where my in-laws live. Hello, in-laws. I don't think you're listening, but just in case.
Radha, what are you drinking / eating?
I was eating Pop-Tarts. I tried to save it for the episode, but guys, cinnamon frosted Pop-Tarts are delicious.
They still are. I mean, this is going to become like the official food of Bombshell, which is frosted Pop-Tarts and rosé.
Right. As I told Radha a moment ago, there are frosted brown sugar cinnamon Pop-Tarts cereal. So combination of all of your great loves.
Just sounds amazing. And I can't believe I didn't know it before right now.
Yeah, I think you're going to have to send John out to get you some here immediately. We do not have a guest on today, but we do have an extended pop culture discussion at the end. So hopefully folks can look forward to that. Shall we just dive right in?
We have some foreign relations to keep up.
There's like a lot of foreign relations to keep up, actually. Yep. I'm tracking elections in at least the following countries: Israel, India, Indonesia, and unfortunately for this alliterative scheme, Ukraine. Anybody got anything else?
Well, Turkey just had local elections.
True.
Okay. But I don't know anything about them. I'm just trying to think of another I country. This is where Eat, Pray, Love is kind of the...
Italy.
Yes.
But they did not have elections.
Right.
You got anything else, Radha? Should we dive into those?
Yeah, let's dive in.
Okay, so we covered Israel a couple of weeks ago. Who wants to update us on the outcome there?
After we discussed last time, against the predictions of some of the more optimistic pollsters, Bibi Netanyahu's Likud party actually increased the number of seats that they hold in the Knesset. They will still need to build a coalition, most likely with more of the right centrist parties. The question remains to me is what sort of negotiation Netanyahu will have to do in order to, one, kind of get him off the hook from his legal troubles, in an exchange for what sort of increasingly far-right policies we will see, such as further control by Israel of the West Bank or of Gaza incursions or anything else that some of the more far-right parties are interested in pursuing in exchange for making sure Bibi doesn't go to jail.
Right. So he, in the run-up, in the last days before the election, suggested that he would annex parts of the West Bank, annex Israeli settlements in the West Bank and for direct control. And so I guess a lot of folks are kind of waiting to see, was that just sort of an election stunt? If it was a stunt, is somebody going to like force him to be accountable to that? The Israeli parliamentary system is itself pretty interesting. There's lots and lots of parties. The whole country is a single member district. They've changed the threshold minimum for like how many votes you have to get in order to get a seat in the Knesset. So it's a totally different system, even if you're kind of familiar with like European multi-party systems. So it makes for pretty contentious coalition politics, but also allows some of the more extreme parties to get kind of veto plays. And there are certain things you have to do to buy them off into your coalition. So yes, that's something that we're all... And then I guess we're also still waiting for Jared Kushner's peace plan.
Yes.
Which is like waiting for Godot in its own sort of way.
Right. And as a reminder, Jared Kushner has not actually spoken to any Palestinian officials in the last year plus about his peace plan because he so offended them that it was not going to be viable for them to continue their negotiations. So anything they propose will be dead on arrival, just by definition. However, because apparently they have actually introduced the concept of maps, which I know sounds crazy, but like maps are not normally a Middle East peace plan negotiation step that you do, at least early on. Because they've done that, they could actually advance the debate to some degree in a way that, you know, Middle East peace wonks will be super excited about, but won't actually have a lot of impact in reality.
We'll have to follow up on that in future discussions.
That sounds exciting. Meanwhile, in India, sometime between April 11th and May 19th, about 900 million Indians will be voting in a parliamentary election. So just as a reminder, this is a more traditional parliamentary system, only in the sense that they will vote on their local candidate, and that will determine the prime minister. The prime minister is currently Modi from the BJP, which is
sort of a more right-wing party and a more Hindu nationalist party than the, I don't know, historic Congress party, which ruled India for a very long time.
That's right. And the election itself has been subject of a considerable amount of controversy. There has been claims of voter suppression, as well as targeted missing voters on the rolls, mainly lower caste and Muslim voters, consistent with the BJP sort of Hindu nationalism strategy. That said, there is sort of widespread voting underway, and with the exception of some delays in the southern part of the country where there was particularly egregious voting irregularities. So I think in the state of Tamil Nadu, they had to delay, at least in parts of the state, some of the election. We expect to see results sort of by the middle of May. It's been pretty controversial because Modi's campaign has really focused on a lot of the Hindu nationalist, anti-Muslim, very caste-focused nationalism push. And so the election itself is seen kind of as a referendum on that strategy.
And it's also, I mean, there's a little bit of similarity. I mean, Israel is almost, if not exactly the smallest democracy, it's pretty close. India is literally the largest democracy. I mean, 900 million people. I'm always fascinated by the logistics of Indian elections, where they spend months hauling out ballot boxes to these remote villages, because there's a law that your polling place should not be more than 3 miles or 5 miles or something from your place of residence, which in a country as large as India is kind of extraordinary. But what's interesting is both in terms of the way that the transformation of those countries, political parties that were present at the founding. So in Israel, that's really the Labour Party, and then Congress in India, both of which are just nowhere. I mean, Labour basically doesn't exist in Israel anymore. And Congress has really struggled to find kind of its successor candidates in the last few years. They're still a party that gets votes, but they're almost the butt of jokes more than they are at the, you know, seating for, you know, political power. So there's some, I don't have a great, you know, explanation of how that's happened in either of those places, but it's a big shift, and certainly one of the challenges for either of those parties to figure out how they get, you know, sort of the center left. I don't know that it's right to call Congress center left exactly, but, you know, reinvigorate opposition to some of these more hardline and ethno-sectarian or kind of nationalist oriented parties in what are essentially multi-ethnic states. India more so than Israel, but there's a significant proportion of non-Jewish residents of Israel. So interesting to watch sort of there. Indonesia.
Yes.
Also a large democracy, not nearly as large as India, but the largest Muslim democracy in the world. And they were they had 83% turnout.
That's amazing.
Which is crazy. So they're expecting to count 155 million ballots, but it's going to take a while. They're not expecting results anytime soon. But because there's been some delays and it's a complicated voting system as well, both candidates have claimed.
Yeah, everyone wins.
Everyone wins. And so it was also a pretty tumultuous election season there. And again, sort of a push from the current president toward more sort of nationalist and maybe hardline or kind of Islamist positions. Islamist politics have a very complicated and interesting history in Indonesia, but we're still waiting for the results there.
So it's going to be a busy May.
Well, meanwhile, we haven't even gotten to Ukraine.
Ukraine?
Oh, yeah. Goodness.
Yep. Ukraine has a runoff, I guess, tomorrow. So theoretically, the results will be out before we've actually released the episode. So in an election runoff between a comedian named Zelensky, who played the president on television in Ukraine, and current president Poroshenko. Zelensky doesn't really have a lot of political views. He's just more sort of at least I'm sure he has political views. He does not have known policy positions that he has put out in a sort of traditional political elections kind of way, much more of a populist candidate with an anti-corruption message. Poroshenko is, of course, a former chocolate magnate.
Really? Yes, I didn't know that.
He is. Yeah. Chocolate versus comedy. I mean, that's actually a really tough choice. how do you do this? But he has come to represent an anti-Russia to some degree pro-Western, but stagnating economy view of Ukraine in a way that I think voters are wildly dissatisfied with. And we will likely see a pretty significant victory go to the comedian. And will be interesting to see what actually political views he has, which seem to be kind of, you know, pro-Western, pro-NATO. Let's get better and make everybody happy. Like that is actually a political view he has, as he wants people to be happy, which I think is not unreasonable, but TBD.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to see how you won't be disappointed with your protest vote. Like, if you're frustrated with the current, I mean, and there's lots to be frustrated with in Ukraine, which has sort of endemic corruption and this really unfortunate geostrategic situation where they'd like to be part of the EU and Russia's like, oh, I don't think so. Let me annex parts of your country. It seems like, no, I guess we're kind of all on the technocratic end of this spectrum, I would say. I would like somebody who kind of has experience negotiating with the EU or dealing with Russia in some sort of way. So I don't really know what the like comedian protest vote actually gets you in this setup.
But just as a reminder who the mayor of Kyiv is right now, a boxer.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. How's that working out for the residents of Kyiv is my only question.
I mean, he's kind of hot.
Well, fair enough.
Right.
Okay. So in less entertaining news and on a much more serious subject, there was a fair amount of violence in Londonderry, Northern Ireland, or Derry, as most of the residents know it by. This is Easter weekend. Easter weekend is very symbolic and historically important, especially for Republicans across Ireland. Republicans in the Irish context mean people who advocate an independent Ireland or a unified Ireland, not the American GOP. Very different. But there was, Rada, were you paying attention to this? There was sweeps or searches on Thursday night that kind of triggered this violence.
Yeah, it's not exactly clear whether it triggered it or whether they're all part of the same thing. So basically, in 1916, there was a famous Easter uprising in Derry, or Londonderry, as it is called by unionists. There is regularly some combination of commemoration slash mayhem surrounding this Easter uprising commemoration or remembrance. So in past years, there has been sort of violence. This year, out of concerns of stockpiling of weapons and ammunition, there were a number of searches. Then there was a pretty wild, quite a bit of mayhem in downtown Derry, including Molotov cocktails and shooting. That resulted in a journalist being killed, likely accidentally or incidentally is a better way to say it. And so that has been the focus of a good amount of condemnation, but also a lot of discussion on a couple of fronts, which are one, that the sort of promises of a soft border and a sort of Good Friday agreement that would bring social and economic stability to the area hasn't really materialized in Derry. And two, whether things are going to get worse or whether this is going to be exacerbated by the ongoing Brexit situation in which a hard border comes out and there's more sort of Republican pushes to unify with the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah, I think we talked a little bit earlier this year. I recently read Patrick Radden Keefe's book, Say Nothing, which is about a murder in 1972 in Northern Ireland. But then really kind of how that conflict plays out over time focuses a lot on Gerry Adams, but also a number of other key Republican figures. And one of the things that he really talks about in the book is how Good Friday was a peace accord, but not necessarily a peace process. There was not a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Northern Ireland. There were a lot of unsolved crimes. And while, you know, the provisional IRA, the provos, you know, who were the purveyors of violence throughout the 70s and 80s, signed up to the accord, there have been a number of splinter factions, you know, over the years. And so there remain remnants of the IRA. There remain a great deal of sympathy for the Republican cause, if not the use of violence in pursuit of that cause. It remains an interesting question. I mean, part of this is sort of, you know, how do you really institutionalize that peace process while keeping, you know, these counties of Ulster part of the UK and not part of the Republic of Ireland, but also, you know, kind of who is the IRA now? What is their support base? I don't think that the average population in Northern Ireland is certainly in any way interested in returning to this violence. You know, on the other hand, You know, Radha, you know, some of the, not all the promises have been fulfilled. Although in general, the integration with the Republic has really improved the economy and the ease of transportation. Maybe that's been felt more in Belfast than it has in Derry. So there's been some upticks in violence earlier this year. I mean, there've been sort of other car bombings and some, I don't know, more communal level violence, maybe you would say, in January and February. This is the first bit that I've seen that's really caught international attention. And I guess we'll sort of see, you know, how that shifts and spreads. One of the things that I noted from Patrick Radden Keefe's book is the way that the Royal Ulster Constabulary, which was a sort of a unionist police force, essentially, becomes into this PNSI, the new police force in Northern Ireland, but it's not clear kind of what reforms or, you know, changes in hiring or changes in the relationship with the British security apparatus took place along with that. So if we have, you know, murders of journalists and, you know, violence in Republican communities, you know, are these, does the population trust the police to effectively investigate and prosecute, you know, across sectarian lines? Or is this still a force that's being used to, you know, persecute Republicans, which was the reputation of it in the, during the Troubles?
It's also just worth noting that a lot of the sort of stability that we take for granted down Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but mostly Northern Ireland, is like relatively recent. When I was looking up about this, you know, the IRA finally sort of decommissioned and turned down and gave up their weapons only in 2005.
Right.
And the loyalist groups were actually later than that. So like in 2009, I think, was the Ulster Volunteer Force, and Ulster Defense Association was even later than that. So it's a relatively recent development, and I think still more volatile than we, I think, at least I had been thinking about when thinking about the situation there.
Last topic here. There's been a lot of goings on in Sudan this week. Friend of the show, Nani Hall Singh, had a great piece in The Monkey Cage, kind of laying out the specifics of the coup itself. So the military removed President Omar Hassan Bashir on April 11th. And then there was quick turnover, one successor, then a second, also from the security or intelligence services, were appointed and then resigned over the next 48 hours. And so there's a bit of a merry-go-round in terms of the exact leadership. But this has been brewing for some time, right?
Yeah, there's been about 4 months, if not more, of pretty significant civil protests against Bashir as a result of extremely bad economy, which in a lot of ways is the result of the loss of South Sudan and some of the oil revenues that came via the access to oil fields in South Sudan, but also some of the costly conflicts that that Bashir has engaged in within the context of Sudan itself. All of these have resulted in some fairly harsh policies that have, you know, cut off subsidies, as well as just like had significant damage to the economy over the last couple of years or so. What's interesting is that there is now a kind of a transitional military council, and you noted that the first head was forced to step down after just a couple of days for a number of reasons. And then the next head is also a military leader who has now changed his tune a bit after initially committing to a 2-year transition with his military council in charge. So now, like, maybe you would hand it over to civilian rule within the next couple of months or so. I think this is reflective of the continuing protests that are going on right now, still saying that, like, we did not ask for Bashir to leave just to hand this over to the military. We want to, you know, see increase in democratic norms and pursue civilian elections. We would actually have a more decisive discussion about, like, the way forward in the country. What's interesting is that who would actually end up in charge if you had an election in Sudan today or in the next couple of months or so. This has shaped a lot of the international reaction, as well as in particular the Middle East reaction towards this sort of pseudo coup. I think a lot of the Middle East partners in the area are pretty comfortable with the military transitional council. We would not be comfortable with having an election which might have more sort of Muslim Brotherhood affiliated elements achieve power in the country itself.
Oh, interesting.
And you may see increased or maybe more decisive foreign interference in this process over the next several months, depending on the direction that they may go. But I not only is the piece that Aaron mentioned in The Monkey Cage really great, there's a lot of pieces in The Monkey Cage on Sudan that are excellent over the past 2 weeks. Frankly, it's the outlet that has covered Sudan in detail and really in great thoroughness in a way that most other media outlets are not doing right now. So highly recommend all of them.
just on a closing note there, it's also remained to be seen what's actually going to happen to Bashir, who is like a international war criminal. And I believe there are pending ICC charges. So there's a sort of open question on not just the transition on Sudan, but what that sort of post-coup leader transition looks like.
Yeah. And like if they decided to hand Bashir over to the ICC or even just like internally have some reconciliation with the crimes that he has committed, a lot of the folks on the current ruling military council are as equally implicated in a lot of those crimes as much as Bashir is. So the way forward on Bashir is going to shape a lot of that discussion on whether the government of Sudan over the next several months in a way that it could be, you know, fascinating and probably unfortunately violent to watch.
That transition could also then be related to whether or not Sudan comes off the U.S. list for state-sponsored terrorism, which would then open up a lot of opportunities for foreign assistance. But if, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood dominates the future council or continues to be, you know, part of the military, I mean, that's going to be a challenge there as well. So lots to watch. And you know, thanks to our friends at the Washington Post and the Monkey Cage for keeping us smart on that. Trade? It's aghast. Radha, do you have a brief trade update for us?
Yeah. And you know, really, this is pretty quick because we're kind of in a waiting game here. But for folks who are tracking this, we are still holding off on imposing this 25% tariff on all goods while the U.S. and China negotiate a deal. As it's happened, actually, the trade deficit with China has actually gone down, which is not surprising because we're charging more for their goods. So people are, and companies in particular, are buying them. So it went down by about 28%. It's at an 8-month low. On the other hand, there's been a lot of talk on how this has hurt both business confidence and supply chains. And there's a lot of questions as to if that those tariffs really, if that nuclear option of tariffs really comes in, how bad that will be. So we're kind of waiting. The coverage this week has actually been really positive on the movement on the trade deal, that it's thought to be more expansive, including guarantees on ag, energy, and industrial goods being traded, with China maybe shifting some punitive tariffs off of ag. But I think there's still been no discussion on resolution of big issues, the two big issues being IP issues, which has long been a sticking point with China. And the other one, which is growing of increased importance, is market structure and this sort of socialized and centralized, heavily regulated market structure in China that causes all sorts of problems. We talked last time about the Huawei implications, where private companies give information to the government. You could imagine that applies in lots of the sectors, including some of the ones that the U.S. is looking to export goods in, like energy. And so there's a really open question as to what is going to happen, whether there will be further liberalizations of the Chinese market as part of that, and whether that will alleviate some of the security and national security, and in particular counterintelligence concerns related to the current Chinese market structure.
Super. We're still avoiding Brexit for the week, essentially, because they're just sort of like in hiatus. I mean, basically season three of Brexit has ended and we're waiting, you know, for the
new. Really need a new script, Aaron.
What I want to know is like whether we're going to get Brexit before we get a new Wolf Hall, the third Wolf Hall novel.
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah.
I'm just assuming that the players in this current season will be recast in some way before the next season starts.
Oh, fascinating. I think you could be right. Although Theresa May gets a full year before she can have another leadership challenge. So it would have to be a general election. Okay. Any hoodle, let's move on to White House mayhem. And we are going to talk about the Mueller report for just a hot minute, even though, as always, we redirect you to Lawfare and assorted other people for more detailed interrogation. But I have said for a couple of weeks, there's only two things I care about in the Mueller report, which is not to say there's only two important things. It's just that I have parochial interests. And my interests are Mike Flynn and whether or not there's an ongoing counterintelligence investigation writ large. So we get a little bit of clarity on a couple of those issues. What else were you guys trying to pay attention to in this? The report obviously came out last week. I was very happy to be on an airplane for most of the day. And so we're just now starting to get some of the more detailed analysis of what's really in the report. What are you guys paying attention to?
There's been some analysis that one of the reasons that Trump was prevented from, you know, pretty overt obstruction is that his political aides were effectively thwarted him openly or quietly throughout a lot of his tenure. They did not do what he asked, both on matters of obstruction of justice, but also on a lot of other policy matters that we've talked about on the podcast. And to me, that is a fascinating and horrifying turn of events in both within the context of the White House, but also in the larger interagency, that we are effectively expected to save Trump from himself because his advisors are defying his orders of a sitting president. I just feel really uncomfortable with that. I'm not quite a like let it all burn down sort of person, but I am a little bit of a like President Trump is the elected senior official in the U.S. government, and if he says something should be so and be policy within the context of his electoral authorities, his orders should be followed to some degree, particularly if we're talking about military orders. And I just feel really uncomfortable.
Begs the question whether they're legal orders.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of the debate, certainly with Don McGahn and others. But yes, it's a very well taken point.
And then, but on top of that, your question about whether or not it's legal orders. So that, I think, is a totally fair criticism. However, if it's a matter of legal orders and his advisors are so uncomfortable with the notion of following his orders, they quietly or openly defy them, then don't we have a broader political problem that we need to be addressing through some other mechanism than just defying the president?
Arguably, yes. Radha, what are you paying attention to?
Yeah, so I have been increasingly interested in the relationship between some of the investigation on the people surrounding the Trump campaign and the sort of ongoing scandals related to security clearances and background checks. So we've talked a little bit about sort of, and actually the Lawfare folks do a really good job of emphasizing that the Mueller investigation was really focused on the criminal charges. It was not a counterintelligence investigation. It's not intended to assess counterintelligence risks. The findings should not be interpreted as dealing with counterintelligence risks. All of that being said, it really does detail the extent to which members around Trump, both during the campaign and as members of the government, were engaging in sort of ongoing conversations with Russians, were sort of willing and accepting of taking advice, so that even though there isn't a conspiracy in a legal sense, it would be very helpful to try to better understand how these relate to concerns about undue influence, financial ties, meetings and connections, a lot of which we've discussed in the context of the background checks for people like Kushner and the Trump children more broadly. So my general issue is in the counterintelligence investigation, not that I'm not interested in the criminal investigation, but I'm not a criminal lawyer, but I'm particularly interested in like how much we're learning here about the degree of contact and what that might imply about the underlying influence between the different parties from a counterintelligence point of view.
So I think as best I can tell, and again, I am both not a lawyer and not spending all of my waking hours interrogating this information, there is an ongoing counterintelligence investigation that exists within the FBI proper that is not within the special counsel's office. And Ben Wittes, as he live blogs his reading of the special counsel report and like, better you than me, my friend, has actually a pretty good sort of summary on this where he says, don't assume the report answers counterintelligence questions. Where it concludes that someone didn't engage in a conspiracy, don't confuse that with answering the question whether there's some counterintelligence risk associated with that person. And I think that's a pretty good mantra on this counterintelligence piece, which is there could be influence. That doesn't mean there was conspiracy, right? I mean, conspiracy requires like a two-way street. Counterintelligence, having leverage over someone could be a one-way street. You might not have done anything to, encourage your foreign counterpart to do something, but if they have leverage over you, whether through financial dealings or compromise or some other, piece of negative information, there could still be foreign intelligence risks that way. There could also just be, and I think this is less the case with the Russians and more the case with maybe the Saudis, for example, just affinity, just like there's a set of, relationships that people have shared, preferences over things that aren't necessarily American foreign policy preferences. So I think from that CI perspective, the Mueller report doesn't answer those questions. I have no expectation that we're going to answer those questions before the 2020 election. Which does remind me that one thing the report does speak to is that the Russians definitely actively sought to manipulate the 2016 election. And it's unclear to me kind of both in a mechanical sense, in a technology sense, in a media sense, you know, what we're doing to inculcate ourselves from that going forward. And that there's a lot of, we have, you know, friends and folks kind of working on that topic. But I think that the Mueller report shed some light on the techniques that the Russians were using. And it's not clear to me that we've developed really good defenses against all of those. So anything else on L'Affaire Russe and the specifics of the Mueller report?
God bless you, L'Affaire.
Yeah.
We owe you some more bourbon and cookies. We'll see what we can do about that. Next in White House mayhem, and this is sort of one of these things where, like, I can't even, like, apparently this happened since we last recorded, but I've, like, lost track of time. We just purged DHS? Question mark?
Yeah.
By we, I mean the president. I don't mean we. I mean, I had nothing to do with it, but.
So
I just want to be clear that we purged them because they were not doing enough bad stuff.
Right. And so Secretary Nielsen was asked to resign along with, or fired, I guess is a, you know, more direct way to say it, along with a lot of her lieutenants, as well as some present nominees within the DHS apparatus, including the current nominee to head up ICE. And yes, as Radha implied, like, Secretary Nielsen is the person who effectively fronted the family separation policy under the Trump administration, not only made sure that it works, but also lied about it to Congress on a number of occasions. So if she was not hardline enough, who exactly is hardline enough for the Trump administration? And I think the answer to that is basically Stephen Miller. But I mean, Stephen Miller's not going to run DHS, but the people.
Well, not officially,
but like the people who have his stamp of approval. But just consider some of the policies that they have looked at over the past year, like closing the border outright, ending birthright citizenship, re-establishing family separation, which they're effectively still doing, but just kind of doing on the sly at the moment, but like doing it in a more
proactive
way. And
also sending asylum applicants or illegal, quote unquote, illegal immigrants to sanctuary cities
right,
by way of political retribution.
Yeah. Which, like, when I read that, I was kind of like, oh, interesting move. Wait, what? What are we doing? What? But what's been, I guess, somewhat depressing in terms of political sense is there has been very little strong Republican response to the purge of DHS, which I think should be concerning regardless of your political affiliation. But it's also noteworthy because I think that the Republican Party is basically being told, like, this is your immigration policy, you know, sign up or get defeated. And that's more or less where the party is right now.
I mean, to be fair, they were defeated in the 2018 midterms. So I think it remains interesting how popular slash acceptable these moves are writ large, but they may be politically advantageous in certain constituencies, whether that's in border states or in certain way that certain congressional districts are drawn. Mm-hmm. This will remain a very interesting political question. It's also a reminder that the DHS really has, you know, Department of Homeland Security is created after 9/11. It's a kludge together department of a number of different organizations, who many of which had existed in other agencies. It includes everything from the Secret Service to what we used to call Customs and Border Patrol, to a new organization called ICE and the Transportation Security Administration, which has a mix of law enforcement functions, domestic law enforcement functions, which really sort of turns it into, it's not quite a domestic intelligence service and certainly doesn't operate in quite that way, but it has many of those features. And so it has a lot of investigative powers. It potentially has a lot of data collection powers. It's responsible for a lot of domestic cyber response. But, you know, I don't know, from the national security career progression track, we don't talk about DHS as like the place to go to like make your career necessarily.
No.
You know, that said, it's got a lot of GS-15 slots because it took in all of those different departments. It's very interesting bureaucratically. You know, buy me a drink sometime and we can talk about that. But what is interesting about this debate to me is that I think DHS is getting the attention it deserves, which is that it should have top flight talent. It should be, yep, have the accountability and the oversight that we provide sometimes to the Defense Department and other organizations, mm-hmm, but instead has sort of flown under the radar, no pun intended. And, you know, we need to pay a lot more attention to it and a lot more attention to the nominees that come through there.
So to your point on elections, what was interesting to me reading a bit of analysis in The Atlantic by Ronald Brownstein is that because Republicans in the House in particular lost in the 2018 election, you ended up having a lot of border state districts lose their Republican representative, or also in the Senate as well. So whereas before you had Republicans who were more open to a less aggressive immigration policy, you've lost a lot of those voices. So now in the Republican Party itself, you have very few voices in the party who are advocating for moderation on immigration in any way. To the extent that you find that in the Democratic Party. It's not to say that Republicans writ large are against immigration reform or immigration moderation, but in terms of elected representatives, you now have the extremist voices are the ones that have actually seat in Congress at the moment.
And then returning to the oversight point you made, Aaron, it's worth keeping in mind, we have a lot of conversations about operational authorities of the Department of Defense and under what authority they're operating and whether those are subject to appropriate oversight and questioning by Congress. We have many fewer of those discussions as it regards to DHS. And so there's a recent set of stories regarding militia groups, essentially U.S. Border Patrol proxy forces comprised of U.S. civilians.
I'm sorry,
detaining
what?
Migrants. Yep. Detaining migrants at the border and then calling Border Patrol and turning the migrants over to the Border Patrol for processing to avoid them illegally entering the country. The ACLU has been in a pretty righteous outcry about this, calling it kidnapping and claiming asking the questions under what authorities are these people allowed to detain civilians, allowed to detain migrants, and why is the Border Patrol taking handovers of militia groups to the Border Patrol. So I think, again, we have conversations about things like non-state actor forces that are partnered with various parts of our national security apparatus. And I think it's worth us remembering there are massive operational authorities that are executed on a daily function at DHS that we have very little insight into and almost no public discussion and oversight on.
How many committees oversee Homeland Security in the House? Something like, or the House and the Senate, something like 80?
For different pieces of them, probably, yeah.
That's too many. Okay. Speaking of Defense Department authorities and the Defense Department in general, there's been a little bit of discussion this week on Defense Department transparency, or rather the lack thereof. There was an announcement this week that DOD would no longer be disclosing detailed numbers with regard to nuclear stockpiles.
Yeah. So I should let Radha expand upon this in detail, but just for historical context, about 10-ish years ago under the Obama administration decided to start declassifying on a regular basis the number of nuclear weapons that are active and being dismantled. And to be fair, those numbers were things that outside groups, particularly those who follow the nuclear debate religiously, they could guess within a pretty reasonable margin of error about how many were in that category, but we didn't have official numbers. So under the Obama administration, that changed and those numbers were released.
That part of the New START process, essentially?
Yeah, it was part of New START. It was part of Obama's overall kind of Prague agenda. Mm-hmm. It was done under the assumption that it was a necessary part of our arms control and non-proliferation agenda overall. So last week, it was technically the Department of Energy who made the absence of release, but DOD was the one who impacted the decision to say we are no longer going to be releasing these numbers. They did not provide a justification as to why. You can make a lot of assumptions about, great power competition. You can note the fact that Russia and China, despite the fact that we've been doing this for about 10 years now, have never even come close to doing more or less the same in terms of their own processes. And there's not been a useful justification under the Trump administration as to what kind of changes they're making in this policy area. But it fits into the overall banner of DOD just kind of less transparent about more or less everything it does right now for good reasons and for zero reasons at all.
Yeah, so just a couple of fun little factoids when thinking about this. So basically, there was a big move to do this in 2010. I think before that, there had been basically nothing except one time in 1993 when they officially disclosed a stockpile. It was kind of the worst kept secret, and there were a number of different watchdog organizations that worked hard to try to track and estimate the number of warheads and information on it. And so in 2010, there was this decision made that the U.S. would release this as under the classification of formerly restricted data, which is basically information that they decide to declassify at this high, what, yes?
Yeah, that's, I mean, formerly restricted data is like the worst nomenclature in all of our, anyway, continue.
So they released this number, and the claim was that this sort of allowed for some transparency and compliance with various nuclear agreements, but also was just like a kind of good faith gesture we did that was trying to sort of move things forward. The Trump administration's concern or stated concern is that this hadn't been reciprocated. So this stockpile declassification hadn't led to greater openness with Russia. And maybe they're concerned about China / maybe they can't declassify the numbers right now. It's not totally clear what the benefit of making this more secret now exactly is, other than that we just don't have to exercise the effort to release it. But it was never totally clear that there was huge benefits to releasing the numbers other than the like transparency benefits, which are non-trivial, but I don't think there was like a deep strategic value. So, you know, we'll just add it to the list.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I could either, on the one hand, I do not have a deep emotional reaction to this kind of in either direction. If the Defense Department was being transparent on a number of other issues, for example, civilian casualties, ongoing operations as under the AUMF, anything related to like regular press briefings, I would say, okay, they've made a considered decision to take this off the table, and, you know, but it's not part of like a bigger issue. But it is. Alternately, if I thought the administration had a more well thought out, acceptable, strategic view toward arms control and how we were going to pursue all of our arms control commitments and therefore the information associated with that, and they had a considered view that this was not helping, or that they wanted to put pressure on Russia to, you know, continue under New START, I could see that, but that is also not what's happening here. So instead, what we have is an administration that's pretty actively hostile to arms control writ large, deeply suspicious of all Russian and Chinese activity, and totally uninterested in disclosing information on a regular basis at the Department of Defense. And so this just sort of smells funny, even though on its face, Radha, as you know, it's fairly defensible, or at least like should not be necessarily regarded with like deep, deep suspicion. But it is just sort of one of many things that point to some unfortunate trends in other areas.
It's the perfect thing that you might defend from the podium of the Department of Defense as the spokesperson of the Department of Defense. But as of May of this year, we have not had a formal briefing for the Department of Defense press corps in a year.
Super.
How fun.
I have like so many pop culture things to talk about. I'm kind of like jumping out of my seat. Are you guys ready to talk about some pop culture?
Yes.
Let's do it.
Go for it.
Okay. We're going to start with the Star Wars trailer because obviously, and there were actually two Star Wars announcements that came out of Star Wars Celebration, but we're not going to talk about the Mandalorians just yet. We're only going to talk about the Star Wars Episode 9 trailer, The Last Skywalker.
The Last Skywalker.
Question mark.
Okay. So
Everybody pause now. Go watch the trailer if you haven't. But obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you've totally already seen this trailer.
Right. Okay. So,
or you're Radha.
I kind of dug Adam Sower's theory on this.
Okay. So pause. This episode, I felt like the last episode of this, you know, the Skywalker saga had kind of like, we'd all moved on from like who were Rey's parents. We sort of decided that was not important. This trailer brings very much back to the forefront, who is Rey? Where does she come from? And who are her parents? Because she's probably not just some random orphan left on a random planet.
Right. And why do we give a shit about Skywalkers writ large?
Correct.
Right.
Because they're all dead.
Because they're all dead.
Well, except for Adam Driver. But
so Adam's theory is that... Adam Sower's theory is that Rey is a clone of Anakin Skywalker.
Which I agree is fascinating. And I've mostly avoided the whole like Rey's parents speculation because as a good reader of Agatha Christie novels, they'll just tell you in the end. And so I find it not useful to speculate. This speculation I find fascinating and certainly more interesting than anything. She's not Obi-Wan's love child, which was the theory that I was most like supportive of from a pure pop culture perspective.
Yeah, she's not Han Solo and Leia's missing daughter because
they didn't recognize her.
Yeah. Or like they wouldn't, that whole theory was like strange.
So,
like,
but there's lots of other things going on here. I think they go back to Endor potentially in this episode.
Possibly. Or Tatooine. Or who knows?
Who knows?
We don't really know where they are.
But I'm pretty excited about this. It's going to come out in December this year. This is not the last time we're going to talk about it. Sorry, not sorry, Rada. But we have other pop culture as relates to the Game of Thrones, which premiered last week, and the second episode will air before this podcast comes out. Today I learned that while Rada does not watch the shows, which honestly is not super surprising, read all the books?
I did.
I haven't even read all the books. Like in the last book, I just skipped the characters
I didn't
like.
The last book was a real slog, guys. The last book was a real slog.
And of course, we don't have the last book because...
No.
And I'm very much of the opinion that there are no pages. There's a great Deadspin article about this, but right. I think there isn't one.
So I'm actually toying with the idea of just reading, you know, the spoilers for the first five seasons and just jumping it at season
You've
six.
Read the spoilers. They're the books.
No, well, I know, I mean, but to know
fair,
what's covered
right.
in the...
Like, it yeah. diverges.
Fair, fair.
It diverges at I some mean, point. You can... And then just like let it wrap up with seasons, with these seasons. And I just don't need to watch all the super rapey scenes.
The first episode was good. Lots of reunions, lots of fan service. And I appreciate.
Yes. My biggest question is like, why the hell aren't lots of people going to Bran and saying, so can you tell me about this thing?
Like, I think they don't know yet. I did see like an excellent article that the reason Bran sort of looks so creepy in his chair is that the actors actually wears glasses and he's not wearing his glasses on the show.
So
and
he's so just he's, like squinting.
He's like looking into the middle distance because he can't actually see anything. And so he has this vacant look on his face. It's amazing. Anyway, lots of discussion. I mean, we got the first answer to R plus L equals J. We won't like spoil all of that for everyone, but also like this is a total spoiler alert. This is happening in real time. You're 6 years late. Get on right. board for the big win here, folks.
Come on.
But I think that there's, so now John knows about his parentage, but nobody else does besides Sam. And so that's going to cinch. That's the only part of this. Much like I only care about Flynn and the Mueller report, I really only care about John's parentage and who finds out when. And everything else is sort of, I feel like it's going to end pretty bleakly. So we'll continue to watch on the Game of Thrones.
Rada, you would really like the clothes?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
They're pretty good.
Well, that's fair. I do like
Sansa and Cersei.
Drama.
I mean, totally, totally on fire.
Yeah. Amazing clothing.
Speaking of amazing clothing.
Killing Eve?
Killing Eve. Are we caught up on Killing Eve?
Yes. Guys, I can't believe I waited so long to watch this, but I binge watched season one and now I'm caught up on.
Oh my God. I didn't realize you hadn't watched. Isn't season one amazing?
It is. I also really enjoy having a true female sociopath who they don't try to justify in any means other than just her enjoying
She's
killing.
Just like a sociopath.
Really, yeah.
Like. She doesn't have like PTSD. She didn't like grow up in a room surrounded by dolls. She's just crazy.
It's fantastic.
Yep. Yes. And now we're talking about Sandra Oh, right?
Have you guys read these books? I've debated whether I want to read these books or whether I just want to watch the show on its own terms because it's sort of so amazing.
I know. I feel like, I mean, I don't know. Could they be better than the show?
They could be different, but yeah. I think that the visual quality to the show is pretty outstanding. We're two episodes in, as I said, the third will come out before this podcast airs. And we got a lot of cat and mouse going on. So we're kind of waiting for a new interaction between Eve and Villanelle. I actually really love Eve's boss. Who is Aunt Petunia from the Harry Potter movies?
Yes.
In case folks hadn't noticed that.
She's totally Aunt Petunia.
Playing
oh,
a
she
very
totally
different
is.
Character. Yes. And she has an excellent discussion about how she always looks so fresh and awake, which is that she has moisturizer made of pig fetus, which I thought was relevant to ourselves and our interests here. Lastly, I got to watch Beyonce Homecoming on one of my flights this week. It turns out I didn't know this until a few months ago. You can download things on Netflix to watch offline, like on an iPad or
wow.
whatever.
Wow. Aaron.
I know. Wow. I learned that. So I do that a lot now and certain things are better to watch on airplanes than others. Things with subtitles are really useful to watch on airplanes because you aren't distracted by your phone. You aren't like watching something else. But Beyonce Homecoming, which is the movie version of her Coachella set from last year, which was this incredible tribute to historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, but was also basically Lemonade and a bunch of other pieces. It is a wonderful visual spectacle. It's got some good interviews with her about the amount of how long the rehearsals took, like both for the music and then for the dancers. I mean, basically it took 8 months to put it together. But also like how hard that was to do, like coming back from a pregnancy with twins and a C-section and kind of all of these issues. You know, she basically has three kids and she's, you know, basically working 12 hours a day, and it's, you know, it's hard even for Beyonce. Right. So it's
vaguely reassuring. I mean, she looks a lot better than many people when doing it, but still.
I mean, she's got a whole team that, yes, there's a whole makeup crew and hair crew working on that. Anyway, it's fabulous. It's among many delightful things that have nothing to do with the Mueller report or, you know, our terrible foreign policy apparatus. So if you're looking for a couple of hours of escape, I strongly recommend that in any context.
There's a new Taylor Swift album coming out soon.
Oh, really?
Yep. Apparently, like, there's a whole like numerology obsession with like why she keeps tweeting about 426. So apparently this is a big deal and it's going to be something related to her new album.
Ah, how about that? We'll let you keep us posted.
Okay.
Anything else, ladies?
I think that's quite enough for today.
See everybody in a couple of weeks.